So a few last thoughts on chapter 20. We had talked about how we want to definitely pay attention to two principles. I think I have another slide coming up that will reaffirm those two principles. But the two principles deal with context. We've got time context, which is things which will shortly come to pass. Shortly come to pass, that's mentioned in chapter 1. That's also mentioned in chapter 22. So the whole book is guided by that. It's not like you have a section of Revelation that has nothing to do with that principle. The whole book is guided by that. Even chapter 22, which sometimes people kind of forget that context, even in chapter 2, it explicitly says these are shortly to come to pass. And so we have to pay attention to the time context. We have to pay attention to the genre context. In apocalyptic literature, one of the biggest things that you will see is symbolism, and it is consistently used. So when you're looking at an apocalyptic book, you don't treat some symbols symbolically and then look at other symbols and say, well, those are literal, because that becomes a very subjective enterprise. You have to be consistent with the genre that we are dealing with. So we want to remember that, especially as we get to the end of the book of Revelation, because it does deal with a lot of these sorts of materials that people forget that context. The last section of Revelation 20 deals with this judgment scene. This is referred to by a lot of people as the Great White Throne Judgment. That is sort of the language that is used there. So we're going to take a look at this. It mentions towards the end of chapter 20 that the sea was no more. Well, let's go ahead and read verses 11 through 15. Who wants to read that for us? John Cullinan, go ahead. Okay, thank you, John. So, a few things about the sea. This is definitely one of those chapter divisions that you just kind of have to ignore, because the sea gives up the dead at the end of chapter 20, and then the sea is no more at the beginning of chapter 21. So we are dealing with the same basic principles. It's not like this chapter 21, you see this big 21 in your Bible, you think, oh, it's totally new material. It's not. It's the same. It's a continuation of this thought, so pay attention to that. The sea in the book of Revelation deals with the mass of the population of the earth, particularly that which is characterized by lawlessness. Another way of saying this would be the way of the world. So the sea is the people that have devoted themselves to the way of the world. They will lose too. And that's the point of this. So we have the sea, we have death, we have Hades. The New American Standard does not capitalize death. I think that is a mistake, because earlier in the book of Revelation, chapter 6, we saw that death was personified. Do you remember the four horsemen? And we had death and Hades following. It was personified. And so death and Hades should, I think, be capitalized here. They are agents of Satan. That's the idea in the book of Revelation. This is the symbol. They surrender the dead, and who are the dead in Revelation but those who are lawless and ungodly? So that would be a symbol indicating that there is no place left to hide, no power to hide behind. The dead, death, and Hades are all cast into the lake of fire, and as we saw in the Old Testament, the lake of fire is not always eternal destruction. It certainly does point to that. Where the worm does not die and the fires are never quenched. Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit about that as we get into chapter 21. But in the Old Testament, it was even used of temporal judgment on Edom, on Sodom and Gomorrah. it was used in ways other than the eternal destination of those who are doomed. So when we think about Revelation, Revelation is borrowing its symbolism from where? The Old Testament. So what should we be consistent with? The usage in the Old Testament. That's what we want to look at. Satan's minions are again depicted as losers. Note once more, Jim McQuiggan says, that the lake of fire is only a second death with reference to those who died in the Roman conflict on Rome's side. The beasts are thrown in alive, so are the devil and death and Hades. The harlot, the beast, the false prophet, Satan, death, and Hades, all in this section of Revelation, are depicted as being cast into the lake of fire. The book of life, obviously a big one in this section. The book of remembrance, those draw on imagery throughout the Bible to point to God's knowledge of all deeds, of the righteous deeds that we have engaged in, of the wicked deeds that we have engaged in. Moses talked about, for my people Israel, who have built this golden calf and have rebelled immediately against you, God, blot my name out and give them a place. God says, no, that's not how it works. Appreciate sentiment, but I will be the one who does that. And then over in Psalms, you get that idea of God's remembrance. Daniel chapter 7, in that judgment scene where we're dealing with the four kingdoms, we see that Malachi, there's again this book of remembrance. It comes up over and over again. It comes up in the letters to the churches in Revelation chapter 3. Comes up in Revelation 13, and Revelation 17, and Revelation 21. It comes up over and over again. And the idea is that God is not overlooking you. And when you are suffering, and when your loved ones are suffering for their faith, what do you want to know? God has not abandoned you. He knows what's going on. So what would be an encouraging image? I know what's going on. I know that you're staying faithful to me. I remember that. I also know about the betrayals that some of your false brethren have engaged in, the lies and deceptions, because remember, in the first century, second century, third century, former Christians were turning in Christians. So he knows. Very encouraging image. Certainly a foreshadowing of the final judgment, but the images here don't fit what we know of final judgment elsewhere in the New Testament, in addition to the context. For example, the righteous have been alive long before. There's this 1,000 years image that these wicked are judged. That does not square with John 5, 28 and 29, which says that everybody's judged at the same time. If you have people being rewarded well before people who are being judged, that creates multiple judgments. That's not what we see in regards to the final judgment. So here we're not really dealing with the final judgment, at least not contextually. Doesn't square with John 5. So attempts to literalize what is obviously figurative and in contradiction. The dead, the raised, the judged, they're cast into the lake of fire. That would signify the total defeat of all Roman allies who supported the empire's effort to destroy the everlasting kingdom of God. They will lose. So what I'm saying here, as a summary, I don't believe that this is the final judgment. I think it points to the final judgment, no doubt. But this judgment is dealing with the same thing that has been dealt with throughout the book of Revelation. Christians were being persecuted and they were being killed, but their source of persecution will come to an end. And that is the point that is being highlighted here. It may be a foreshadowing of the final judgment, but I don't think contextually it is in reference to the final judgment. And that will kind of be a springboard into chapter 21, which I think people sometimes misuse too, and they just throw the context out the window. A few concepts in chapter 20 that we wanted to talk about. What God wants made clear is, just as surely as I've protected you right now, I will protect you in the future. Just as I have made you victorious through this present crisis, I will make you victorious in the future. That was that Gog-Magog imagery. As surely as I've defeated Rome for you, I can and will do it with anyone at any time. And he gives a good synopsis here. Why is the devil said to be bound 1,000 years? To indicate he is perfectly and totally defeated, in reference to his use of Rome against the Lord and his church. Why is he loosed a little time? Because after Rome, there will be others to oppose the church, and that little time is the way the future efforts of Satan are covered. To whom was judgment given? To those who sat on the thrones and who represented the saints who lived to see Rome go under. What are those who died in faith to Jesus? They are presented as experiencing a resurrection to thrones along with their brothers. Why is the reign said to be 1,000 years? To portray its perfectness and completeness. Why is the resurrection designated as the first? To differentiate it from the next one he sees, the second. Who are the rest of the dead, those who didn't die for Jesus, but in the service of the beast? Why don't they live again during the 1,000 years? Because that's an experience only for the triumphant saints, victors over Satan and Rome. What do they endure? They endure 1,000 years of death while the saints reign, and then they're resurrected to die a second time. What does the second death symbolize? Utter, irrevocable defeat. That pretty much brings you all the way through chapter 20 and answers all those heavy questions. I think he does have the best understanding of this. I don't think Harkrider gets it. I don't think Haley gets it. I think McGuigan really, there's some things that I would disagree with him on. I think he does a good job of bringing this all together, giving us a big picture, tying into the context. And I know that that is not necessarily how everybody sees it, but I can't speak to how everybody sees things. I can only speak to what I feel convinced of. So that's where we are. Any last thoughts on chapter 20 before we get into chapter 21? Any observations that you want to make? John Reed.
Sometimes the Revelation was written in the way that they were disguised from the Roman authorities, but even if that's partially true, it'd be very unlikely that they would spend enough time with it to realize it was talking about them. I mean, the Christians would have they'd have to do some real deep study to figure out what it means to them. So to the heathens, to those that weren't dedicated to God, it would just be another fairy tale that wasn't worth reading.
Yeah. Plus, you have to remember the Romans have been around for a little while, so you know they're used to people saying, you know, Rome's going to come to an end. They're like, yeah, 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 okay. Any other thoughts? Andrew.
Just real quick, just an observation. I know that we have a greatly different opinion with the majority of other people when it comes to this section and Revelation in general.
Yeah. Are you thinking of like millennialism in particular?
Mm-hmm. But if we can somehow work from, instead of just coming from the standpoint, we're just going to disagree with everything.
Yeah.
Instead of, if we focus on one, we're going to have a completely different opinion. Start with what we can agree on.
Yeah.
Is Jesus ultimately the victor?
Yep.
Instead of just outright missing an opportunity to engage with somebody.
That almost sounds like a commercial for your upcoming evangelism class. How to respond, how to deal with those sorts of things, and how to engage. Yeah, we've been talking about somebody that he is studying with, and she has some very different viewpoints, and sometimes she'll bring something up that's just, whew, off the wall, you know. And I said, just one step at a time and take advantage of the time that you have. So definitely good advice there, Andrew. Let's jump into chapter 21. Chapter 21 and 22, really the capstone for the entire book. glorious vision of the victorious church. Lots of good things, but by way of reminder, proceed with caution. Don't forget the past 6 months that we've been studying the book of Revelation. Don't forget those principles that we've talked about. All of what happens in 21 and 22 relates to the rest of the book. Sometimes people think this is like just some postscript that has nothing really to do with it. No, the whole book has been pointing to this. The church will win over its oppressors. That's the whole point. God will win. So, many have taken for granted that the scene now shifts to heaven, and many of our songs of heaven borrow from this imagery, reinforcing the notion. It seems more consistent to stay with the context and contrast the church's victory with the defeat of the dragon, beast, and harlot in chapters 18 through 19, as we'll show here in a second on another slide. I do think that it points to heaven, but I do think there's something else primarily that's being dealt with here. So two things: time context, things which will soon take place, and genre context. The first century Christians, they're still waiting the final judgment, if you can talk about waiting. I know that's kind of hard for us because beyond death, it's hard to envision time because time is relative to things that we can put our hands on. But I know that it's hard for that, but here we are thousands of years later, and they're still waiting. It doesn't seem like things which will soon take place, does it? So we got to be consistent with the context here. By the way, the scriptures, like in Daniel, for instance, he does say to bind these things up because they are afar off. And that is in reference to something that happens like 500 years later. We're talking about multiple thousands of years since this has been written. And we try to argue that it's, you know, anything other than things which will soon take place. So I wanted to put this slide up, because I don't want anybody thinking, hey, you know, Eric looks at Revelation 21, 22, and he just wants to get rid of heaven. That's not true. Absolutely, it points to heaven. But I do think that its primary application is not heaven. It points to heaven. And so I wanted to introduce this idea to you. This is something that we've talked about a little bit in times past, the now but not yet, right? We are citizens in God's kingdom now. But are we in our fullest glorified state? Not yet. We get fellowship with Christ now, but it is at its fullest manifestation. Not yet. And so this is called, in the technical nomenclature, inaugurated eschatology, now but not yet. And so this concept of I will dwell among them comes up over and over again in the scriptures in a variety of different ways. So, for instance, in Eden, God is walking in the garden after they have sinned, and he says, where are you? There obviously was an intimate relationship there because God was with Adam, told him to name the creatures, told him to keep the garden, gave him a wife. So obviously there was an intimate connection. God was dwelling in Eden with Adam and Eve. The tabernacle. At the end of Exodus, God would dwell in the tabernacle. That would be his presence. The temple. God's spirit fills the temple so much that the priest can't even go in there. God is dwelling among his people. Jesus. Great manifestation of this. Emmanuel means God with us. John chapter 1 verse 14 says that the word tabernacled, dwelt among us. The church. Jesus is the head of the church. He dwells in the church, just as the Father dwells in the church, just as the Holy Spirit dwells in the church. And all of these things, what are they pointing to? Heaven. Because that will be the great fulfillment of God dwelling among his people. So what everything pointed to, the tabernacle, the temple, Eden, Jesus, everything is pointing to this idea that we can be with God in a fuller, greater sense. We will see God face to face. That's what it's all pointing to. So if you wanted to take this sort of, you know, arc or whatever you want to call this, angle, and you could think about this from a variety of other explanations too. Anytime you see a victory in the Bible, what does it ultimately point towards? God's total defeat of Satan. That will come about at its appointed time. Every victory points to that. So when we study Revelation 21 and 22, we see this victory, this victorious church, what is it ultimately pointing to? Heaven. The great victory. So lest it's misunderstood, the primary application of this is God is victorious through these first century Christians and the problems that they are facing, the difficulties that they are facing, and this will foreshadow heaven. Okay? Agreeable? A few thoughts here. Again, by Jim McWiggin. The church has come through a major crisis. She had defeated her enemy thanks to her Lord. And there follows in these two chapters a description of the triumphant and vindicated family of God. He will talk about her newness. He will speak about the newness of her environment. He will talk of her beauty and purity. He will speak of her stability and strength. He will speak of her importance and her testimony. He will speak of her holiness. And each of these things he will set forth in different figures. For example, her new environment will be spoken of as a new heaven and earth. He will speak of her beauty in the terms of an unbelievably precious city with golden streets and jeweled walls. He will speak of her purity and dedication to him under the figure of a bride. He will talk of her stability and strength under the figure of her four-squaredness and her incredible walls of height and thickness. He will speak of her importance and testimony in terms of the light she, as a city, gives to the nations around. And that last part of that quote, in Revelation 21 and 22, this city provides light to the nations. So if this city is heaven, in what way does heaven shed light on those who are burning forever in hell? It doesn't really fit. Not in that primary context. But if we see the church is overcoming Roman oppression and still influencing people, even broadening its influence after it comes out of this, it makes more sense, doesn't it? So let's take a look at the first section, verses 1 through 8. And the first section deals with the holy city. Our plan today is to get through chapter 21, verse 21. And then Wednesday we will pick up in 21, verse 22 and go through the end of chapter 22. But this first image is of the holy city. And there are two things that I want to show as far as structure today in this chapter. Revelation is beautifully structured. You can see it a little bit in English. You can see it more so in Greek. But I wanted to show you a few things here as far as this first section. You have the new situation of God's people called a new heavens and earth. We will return to this idea in verse 5. All things are made new. We have a first heaven and earth passed away in verse 1, second half of verse 1. We will return to that idea at the end of verse 4. Former things have passed away. Verse 1, the sea is no more. We will return to that in verse 4, everybody's favorite verse in Revelation 21, where death, sorrow, pain are no more. We have the new Jerusalem bride, and we have God with his bride. And whenever you see a structure like this, this is called inverse parallelism. And sometimes you'll have kind of a midpoint. That's a chiasm in particular. But usually you look at the middle point and that's what's being highlighted. So what's being highlighted here in chapter 21, particularly verses 1 through 8?
The church.
Particularly, what about her? And their faith, their purity, and their loyalty are because they have come out of the oppression, come out of the affliction. Remember in the seven letters, God said to the one who overcomes, to the one who overcomes, I will give a portion of the paradise. To the one who overcomes, his name will be in the book of life. To the one who overcomes, I will give him a crown. To the one who overcomes, over and over again. So the purity of this bride is the fact that she has maintained fidelity. These are the Christians that have overcome, though they were persecuted. So that's the whole point, that the church has been faithful, and in their faithfulness, they have been given exaltation. They have been given victory. But only those who have maintained their purity, because as we see elsewhere in some of Jesus' parables, if somebody's not dressed appropriately, somebody's not dressed in pure garments, do they get to participate in the wedding? No. Do they get to participate in the feast? No. You have to have pure garments. And pure garments in the book of Revelation are those who have been washed in the blood of the Lamb and those that have maintained fidelity. So let's take a look at a few of these ideas. It's becoming more popular to hear people talk about a new heavens and a new earth, even in the Brotherhood. The Scriptures use that language, so we have to explain that. We can't just say, the Scriptures use that language. They use it in a lot of different places, actually. They use it here, use it in Isaiah, use it in 2 Peter. The Scriptures use that language, so we have to be able to explain that language, because at the end of time, what does the Scriptures tell us about the earth? That it will be burned up, it will be dissolved in 2 Peter chapter 3. And yet 2 Peter 3 also talks about a new heavens and a new earth. So we have to be able to explain that. We can't just dodge that bullet. We have to be able to explain it. So, let's talk a little bit about the new heavens and the new earth. Remember, in chapter 20, in verse 11, that the old earth and heaven had fled away. That old situation was one of corruption, blasphemy, and persecution. The sea is no more. So the sea of chaos and death, the sea which was a barrier between God's people and himself, the sea that was characterized by rebellion among God's people, broadly speaking, not necessarily the church, that's no more. And so what this is, if you were to use kind of another inaugurated eschatology term, this is a new exodus for God's people. They are coming out of oppression. They are coming out of Babylon, in other words. This is a new exodus for God's people. Now, I want you to think about these things, and if you have these notes, just make a little star or write these passages down. I want you to look at these passages because they will really help you to understand chapter 21. In Isaiah 13, we have the destruction of Babylon by the Medes. That is described in a lot of the same way as chapter 20 of Revelation, a lake of fire. That's temporal judgment on Babylon. And it specifies that it's by the Medes. Isaiah 34, we have the destruction of Edom. They are said to be burning forever. Their smoke ascends forever. And yet the passage also says that animals dwell there. So if smoke ascending forever is pointing out hell, how do we explain that? It's symbolism. It's a genre that uses these symbols. Micah chapter 1, it's used of Judah, God's people. Nahum chapter 1, Tom's not here, he would love this reference. Nahum chapter 1, this is the judgment upon Nineveh, described in the same basic way as what we saw at the end of chapter 20. And by the way, if you're using symbolism to talk about disaster and defeat with smoke ascending forever, what kind of image would you use, or what kind of imagery would you use to describe the person who's victorious through that all? Jewels, a fortified city, protection, perfection, exaltation. With the demise of Rome, God's people enter a better situation. Think about that new status, a new heavens and a new earth. Just like we saw in the Old Testament, the sky is falling, the stars are falling, the moon turns to blood. Did those literally happen? No. Are they going to literally happen? No, because that is apocalyptic literature is what that is. It's symbolism. So when we have a new heavens and a new earth, is that going to literally happen? No, that's a symbol. The symbol of a new state. a new heavens and a new earth, if you were to look at Isaiah, where this originates, this language, God's spiritual kingdom would replace the old order. Now, God's spiritual kingdom overcomes the kingdom of Satan, the current kingdom of Satan, and it will overcome any kingdom of Satan. At the end of times, God will destroy all enemies and bring in a new heavens and a new earth, 2 Peter chapter 3. But this is not a pretext to explain a physical earth, a regeneration of the physical earth, because that runs aground on a lot of other passages. That's why the context is so important here. That's why we want to pay attention to the time context, things which will soon come to pass. So I want to pay attention to the genre context, the symbolism, understanding where it comes from. The second symbol that comes up here is the holy city. The holy city, or New Jerusalem. The church has already been described as a holy city. Back 10 chapters ago, it's been described that way. Chapter 19, the church was depicted as a bride in particular, but they have been also described as a city previously. And where is this city coming from? In chapter 21. Out of heaven. It's coming down out of heaven. Not heaven itself, but something that comes out of heaven. Something that comes out of heaven. In Revelation, things associated, coming down out of, voices coming from heaven are related to God, salvation, purity, and victory. And remember, the two beasts came up out of the sea. They came up out of something, the sea and the earth in chapter 13. That's human origin. That happens in Daniel 2, or Daniel 7. While the beasts are said to rise out of the sea and the earth, the messianic kingdom, embodied in the Son of Man, rides in the heavens. Here we have divine nature and origin contrasted to human and evil origin. Now, with a flagrant disregard for mixing metaphors, John doesn't just depict the church as a city. He depicts the church as a bride. And so remember, in apocalyptic literature, there is some fluidity to what they will use and discuss. But we are familiar with this because he talked about this in chapter 19. Definitely an Old Testament backdrop for this. Contrast the harlot that Satan was using. She was full of immorality. She was full of drunkenness and murder, oppression. She was clothed in wickedness. Now we have the bride of Christ clothed in purity. That is an intentional contrast. Two cities, two women, two different ways of depicting these things. So that would be a symbol of the victorious saints who maintain faith in the crucible of persecution. The city of temporal victory will become the city of ultimate victory. Remember that inaugurated eschatology. It's all pointing to heaven. So as the church in the first century, second century, third century overcame Roman oppression, when you get past that and you deal with the Ottoman Empire, who's going to be victorious? The persecutors or God's people? God's people. You get to the Middle Ages, who's going to be victorious? Those who are in hostility towards God's people, the kingdoms of earth, or God's kingdom? When we get way forward to the age of technology, the Industrial Revolution, and we think about all these different factors that are attacking the church and trying to eviscerate the church, who is going to win, those factors or the church? The church. And so all this points to our victory. He will dwell among them, verses 3 and 4. That is intimate fellowship between God and the saints that is rooted in covenant language and prophecies. And that talks about an exclusive relationship. God dwells among those who abide in him. That's an exclusive relationship. God describes himself as being exceedingly jealous and zealous toward his people. And this will again point to the ultimate victory in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 26, where death, lowercase d, is destroyed. Death shall be no more, in this context, speaks to the dissolution of the current source of death, personified death, which was happening through the Romans. And there is an example of a pagan nation who afflicted God's people being referred to as death. Assyria, I believe it is, in Isaiah 28, it says that they had, that God's people had made a covenant with death. Well, who had they made a covenant with? Assyria. And so a pagan persecuting nation being referred to as death. We have an Old Testament backdrop for that. I am making all things new. God is taking away persecution and martyrdom by the malevolent force of Rome. Again, temporal ideas in the Old Testament where you've got a resurrection of God's people and the destruction of his enemies. And he says, it is done, it is accomplished, it is finished. That's a call back to 16, verse 17, in the seventh bowl, when the seventh bowl was poured out, it is finished, is what the angel had said. That would be God's completed purpose being fulfilled. The purpose for letting Rome reach its bloody zenith has been realized and brought to an end. All people are freely invited to drink from the fountain of living water. Again, an Old Testament backdrop. Jesus talked about this with the Samaritan woman at the well. And again, we have new covenant language, new Exodus language. Whoever overcomes, he will, as a son of God, inherit the new status and situation. That is, idea of sonship is over and over again in the scriptures. Hosea 11, verse 1, out of Egypt I've called my son. Particularly Israel coming out of Egypt and the persecution there. Jeremiah 31, it's where the new covenant happens later in that chapter. Psalm 2, Psalm 89, both in reference to Jesus being the Son of God who gives us sonship. 2 Samuel chapter 4, or chapter 7, David's son, the Messiah in particular, would rise to ascendance. Same concept throughout the Old Testament. Verse 8, but, you may remember as a kid, or you may remember hearing kids say, Revelation 21:8, liars go to, yes, liars go to hell. That's what you hear there. But you have to think about this again against the backdrop. Those who do not overcome the influence of Rome, the crucible of persecution, those who compromise with the imperial cult are destined for a lake that burns with fire and brimstone. That's why Revelation 21:8 calls out the cowards. That's why it calls out those who lie. That's why it calls out murderers, people who had given over their brothers and their sisters. Again, honoring the context, not a general statement of final judgment, but the fate that befell the beast and the false prophet and the devil, death and Hades, and anyone not found in the book of life. At one time, it looked like the cowardly, abominable murderers were winning, but they have been defeated in the end. It brings us to a few thoughts in verses 9 through 21. We'll just hit a few highlights because we're running out of time in our class, but definitely structure here as well. Glory of God, bookended. Gates, the gates materials, the wall materials, and the measurements. You may read through this, and you may wish it was structured a little bit differently, but this is intentionally pointing to the completeness of God's furnishings for his people. Verses 9 and 10, this angel says, come here and I will show you what's going on here. And what happens is John is carried away in the spirit, just like Ezekiel was. You may remember in Ezekiel chapter 40, Ezekiel gets a vision of this new tabernacle of God's people. The same concept here. This is sort of a new tabernacle for God's people, that they will come out of affliction, as Ezekiel saw it, out of Babylon's affliction, and as John sees it, out of Roman affliction. This angel will also be the one who measures the city. John had measured things earlier. Now this angel will be measuring. You look back at Ezekiel chapter 40, that was for protection. Zechariah chapter 2 was used to indicate God's presence within. Here, obviously used to describe the city's perfection. You see, for instance, multiples of 12. 12 is the idea of completeness, a particular reference to God's people. And if you have the New American Standard, I love the New American Standard, but it butchers the language here because it takes away the 12s. It'll talk about 144 cubits, for instance. It'll call it, you know, it'll kind of change it into yards, or instead of saying 12,000 furlongs, it will say 1,500 miles. 1,500 miles kind of loses that 12 symbolism, but it is 12,000 furlongs. The whole point is to use that 12 to indicate God's people. And in verses 19 through 20, you got a lot of different gems and jewels that are talked about. We have really not a whole lot of idea about what those gems looked like, because the names change over time. Did you do the second one? You did it? All right. 2 minutes. The holy city having the glory of God. It's brilliant as a costly stone, like crystal clear jasper. That's how God the Father was described in chapter 4 and verse 3. It has a great and high wall, 144 cubits thick. How does 12 fit in 144? 12 times. Completeness. Made of jasper, again connected to God and his appearance. That's a symbol for security and protection. Has 12 pearl gates. You probably have heard heaven called the pearly gates. That's where this comes from. 3 on each side, angels at the gates, each gate bearing the names of the tribes of Israel. Those gates were exits in chapter 48 of Ezekiel. They are entrances here. And the symbol would illustrate entrance is made available to anyone who wants to get in. Not just one gate, it has 12 gates. If you want to get in to the victorious church, you can get in. 12 foundation stones adorned with precious stones bearing the names of the 12 apostles of Jesus. That would be a symbol of endurance and permanence. And there is a city of jewels in Isaiah as well. And by the way, 8 of the 12 of these stones are the high priest's stones. It is laid out as a cube or as a square, but it does use that imagery of being 12,000 furlongs high as well. To give you an idea of what 1,500 miles looks like, that would be 250 of Mount Everest stacked up on top of one another. That's how tall the city is. That's how wide the city is. That's how broad the city is. That would cover the entirety of Europe and more. So it is obviously a very big image, but not meant to be taken literally. We're not going to have a big cube descend from the clouds upon the earth. That's not going to happen. The imagery is what we're looking at here. Again, it would cover Europe and reach into space. And typical Roman cities laid out as a square, so probably mockery there as well. And the last point, city was pure gold, like clear glass. By the way, if you have very refined gold, is it clear? It's not. So this is an image, right? This is symbolism. Gold is precious, and it is valuable. That is the point. It has a street of pure gold. Well, how do you have one street with 12 gates? It's symbolism. It's symbolism. That's a symbol, obviously, for beauty, splendor, and glory. And the overall message of Revelation is God wins. In the end, God wins. I know I kind of fast-tracked that, but by now you should be used to it. We're going to wrap up the end of 21 and 22 again on Wednesday. Lord willing, I can stay healthy and well, and I'll be gone this upcoming Sunday. Thank you for being patient with the class. We only have one last class on the book of Revelation, and we have studied arguably the most complex book in all the scriptures. So I appreciate you working with me, appreciate your patience, and I hope that it has been helpful. One more class, and I hope that you will look at the notes and study that chapter, devote your time to it.